Hello and welcome to the first 10 pages. That's right, it's called the first 10 pages. Why? Because they say in Hollywood when you're trying to get people to read your script and to love your writing, you have 10 pages to get and keep their attention. If you don't do it in the first 10 pages, you lose them. Now, if we're being really honest, you probably have one page. But the rule of thumb is 10 pages, so we're gonna go with that. That's what the podcast is about. We analyze how the first 10 pages affect a script, and thus the movie that you saw on screen. And we're usually going to do movies that everybody's seen. And last time we did Pulp Fiction, this time we, and I keep saying we, but it's me, are doing Jaws. So, let's talk about a few things of what Jaws was. It is, of course, a classic. It starred Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, and Richard Dreyfuss. There's other people in there, but those are the main three that people concern themselves with. It released in 1975 by Universal. It was Steven Spielberg's first big movie, his second feature release, theatrical release, but his first big summer blockbuster. I don't actually know, now that I say summer blockbuster, if it was planned or expected to be a summer blockbuster. I don't know what there being Universal's marketing push was. Summer blockbusters weren't really a thing yet. You know, the event movie hadn't happened. Star Wars hadn't happened. I'm Keith. I'm a sometime screenwriter. I've done a little bit of script doctoring, and then I've gotten some accolades from contests and what they call laurels from festivals and things like that. The way this works is I'm going to read the script. There's got to be a script read because you don't have it in front of you as far as I know, but there will be a timestamp if you want to skip that script read. I'll try to make the script reads a little fun, a little funny, do some voices and push through them a little more quickly than maybe they would be read on, you know, film. Then we break it down. We discuss the different elements. Skipping the script read, go to 1435 to 1436. Stillness in the Water, aka Jaws, by Carl Gottlieb and Peter Benchley. From the novel by Peter Benchley. Over black, sounds of the inner spaces rushing forward, then a splinter of blue light in the center of the picture. It breaks wide, showing the top and bottom of a silhouetted curtain of razor-sharp teeth, suggesting that we are inside of a tremendous gullet, looking out at the onrushing undersea world at night. Here, a symphony of underwater sounds, landslide, metabolic sounds, the rare and secret noises that certain undersea species share with each other. Also, the hint of familiar music, twisted and distorted by the depths. Cut to exterior beach, night, shark's point of view, rising out of the water. Looking at, it is a pleasant moonlit, windless night in mid-June. We see a long, straight stretch of white beach. Behind the low dunes are the dark shapes of large, expensive houses. Hear a number of voices singing. It sounds like an Eastern University's alma mater, no longer distorted. Exterior beach, night, another angle. Around a blazing bonfire, a group of young men and women, beer cans, or maybe a keg in evidence, as well as the Bota Spanish leather wine bag, much in favor by beach and ski bum types. The group is swapping sentimental alma maters, weepily singing Eastern, Ivy League anthems, Dartmouth, Cornell, Harvard, Penn, etc. Two young people break away from the others. They are Tom Cassidy and Chrissy. Behind them, there is considerable necking activity. Tom and Chrissy are more serious. Tom makes a clumsy attempt at snaring Chrissy, cups her from behind. She squirms playfully at his grasp. We discover he's not especially sober. Tom.
Hey! Hey, hey, I'm with you, right?
Exterior, another part of the beach, night. Tom and Chrissy are separated from the others. Silhouetted against the fire, she pauses and looks at the ocean. He is plodding along in the sand, winded. Chrissy runs down the slope of the dune towards the water, leaving Tom reeling atop the dune. As she runs, she is shedding her clothes. Tom is trying to trail her by her clothes, like Hansel following breadcrumbs through the woods. But Chrissy is way ahead of him. Chrissy,
come on!
She runs headlong into the inviting sea, plunges cleanly into the water with a light whoops as the cold water sweeps over her. Behind all this, we continue to hear the sentimental, beery chorus of alma maters. Then we see it. A gentle bulge in the water. A ripple that passes her a dozen feet away. A pressure wave lifts her up, then eases her down again like a smooth, sudden swell. Chrissy.
Tommy, don't dunk me.
She looks around for him, finds him still on the beach, his feet tangled in his pants, which have dropped around his ankles. She starts to swim back in to him. Exterior Chrissy, in the water. Her expression freezes. The water bulge is racing towards her. The first bump jolts her upright, out of the water to her hips. She reaches underwater to touch her leg. Whatever she feels makes her open her mouth to scream, but she's slammed again, hard, whipped into an arc of about 8 feet up and down, submerging her down to her open mouth, choking off any scream she might try to make. Another jolt to her body, driving her under so that only her hair swirls on the surface. Then it too is sucked below in a final and terrible jerking motion. Hold on the eddies and swirls until we're sure it's all over. Exterior, close on Tom, on beach. In his shorts, laughing to himself, turning in slow stone circles, held prisoner by his windbreaker, which seems to have him in an armlock, as he struggles to free his arm from a tight sleeve. As he turns, we hear the alma maters in the background from the fire. Interior Brody House, bedroom, early morning. A shaft of morning sun blasts through the crack between the bottom of the shade and the windowsill, falling across the heads of the sleeping couple on the bed. It catches Martin Brody right across the eyes, bringing him up from sleep. The job is completed by the clock radio, which clicks on with local fisherman's report and weather. Radio announcer. His landing reports conditions good with stripers and jacks. The Coast Guard has no storm warning from Block Island to Cape Hatteras. A light chop with freshening winds continued clear and mild. Ellen Brody burrows her head under the covers, avoiding morning for a few precious minutes more. Brody, how come the sun didn't used to shine in here?
Ellen, 'cause when we bought the house it was autumn. This is summer. Feed the dogs.
We hear the scampering toenails of two cocker spaniels scrabbling around the foot of the bed. Brody swings out of bed, wearing shorts, socks, and t-shirt. Brody,
right.
Do you see the kids?
Probably out in the backyard.
In Amity, you say yard.
She gives it the Boston sound.
The kids are in the yard, playing near the car. How's that sound?
Like you're from New York.
Gives it Brooklyn sound.
Give me 30 years, I'll get it.
He leads the dogs out of the bedroom and down to the kitchen. Interior, Brody kitchen, morning. Brody enters, sets down some dog food, goes to make coffee. Starts to fill kettle to boil water. The cold water rushes through and out the burnt-out bottom of the kettle. Brody,
did you burn another kettle? You know, you're a fire hazard. This is the third one.
Ellen, off-screen.
I never hear the whistle.
Feed the dogs.
Ellen Brody, a tall, attractive blonde woman, enters from upstairs. She's still slightly sleepy. Not what you'd call an instant-on person. Mornings are not her best time.
You want to go through those?
She indicates bag of clothes.
I'm taking them to the thrift shop. It's Marsha Vaughn's pet charity. Pick out what you want. It's mostly your city clothes.
Brody, looking through bag, remembering,
I used to wear this to the garden. Garbage strikes. Dog shit, muggers.
He puts it all behind. Ship it.
Don't be silly. You're going to make summer better for them.
Before Brody can answer, I don't understand what that was.
Used to wear this to the garden, garbage strikes, dog shit, muggers. He puts it all behind. Ship it. Don't be silly. Don't be silly. You're going to make summer better for them.
Before Brody can answer, Michael, his oldest boy, enters holding his hand. There is bright new blood on it, but he is sensibly unconcerned. It's a normal childhood scrape. Michael,
cut my hand. Hit by a vampire.
Brody,
on the swing. I told you not to play near there until I sanded it down.
See what your son did.
Go upstairs and bring Mommy a Band-Aid.
Michael goes on out and upstairs. Ellen fumbles in her pocket and produces Brody's new glasses, which she holds out to him.
Don't forget these.
Oh, yeah. He puts them on. How do I look? Older, huh?
I think they make you look sexy.
Brody reacts to this and bends to kiss her lightly, then more seriously.
Sexy, What was I before?
Older, sillier.
Brody, as he goes to make coffee, he fumbles with the new glasses.
I don't want to depend on these things, you know? Sometimes you can weaken your eyes.
He looks out the window to the view beyond, discovering some new wonder in the fresh, sunlit morning. Brody's point of view outside the house. Sean, the younger child, is happily romping in the summer air, enjoying the very air he breathes.
Let's see.
The phone rings. Interior Brody kitchen, day. Brody answers one of two phones on the wall.
Brody? Yeah? What's up? Well, what do they usually do? Float or wash up? Really? Okay. I'll meet both of you at the beach in...
Checks watch.
20 minutes. Okay?
Okay. Hangs up.
First goddamn weekend of the summer.
Michael re-enters in bathing trunks with a towel on his shoulder, his hand washed, holding a Band-Aid ready for application. Ellen takes it and bandages the finger with care and affection.
There.
To Brody.
What was that?
Michael heads toward the beach, Brody struggling to get his shirt on over his glasses.
The office.
He gets his shirt on with Ellen's help. She flicks imaginary dust from the badge on his chest.
Be careful.
Here?
You gotta be kidding. He gives her a light kiss, starts to go with his cup. Love ya. Ellen, kissing him back. Hey, Chief, bring my cup back. At the door, he takes a windbreaker off a peg and goes on out. We can see the Amity police shoulder patch as he goes to a van parked outside. Exterior, Island Highway, morning. Martin Brody's Country Squire police wagon rushes past, taking the view to an enormous billboard depicting a typical summer day in Amity. A beautiful model splashes in the gold surf, languishing in a solar cane sun. Amity welcomes you, is written above her flailing arms. Exterior, Amity Beach, day. Three small figures in the landscape walking the beach. The surf is rough, and there is seafloor debris strewn about from the receding tide. Closer angle, Deputy Hendricks is searching the shore about 100 yards downwind. Meanwhile, Brody, in his casual police attire, and Tom Cassidy, still in the clothing we saw him in last night, walk down the beach. Brody fingers the missing girl's shoes, purse, and clothes. In the daylight, Cassidy misconducts himself, wavering between inflated maturity and tear-blown adolescence.
Christine what? Worthingsley? Worthington? No one ever died on me before.
You picked her up on the ferry?
I didn't know her.
And nobody else saw her in the water?
Somebody could have. I was sort of passed out.
Think she might have run out on you?
Oh, no, sir. I've never had a woman do that. I'm sure she drowned.
You from around here?
No. Cambridge, Harvard. My family's in Tuxedo, New York, though.
You here for the summer?
Some friends and me took a house.
Brody, genuinely curious.
What do you pay for a place just for the summer?
$1,000 apiece, something like that. There's five of us, and we each kick in $100 a week for beer and cleaning, stuff like that.
A shrill whistle makes them turn. Hendricks is 50 yards away, on his knees. He blows again, a feeble report, this time.
Maybe that's your girl.
Brody runs toward Hendricks. Cassidy hesitates, then follows with, pathetically,
"You can't make me look."
Master Angle, the sand dune. A skein of seaweed garnishes the base of this isolated dune. The booming waves and fizzing surf make dialogue inaudible. Deputy Hendricks on hands and knees, looking white as a sheet. Brody tells Cassidy to wait at the foot of the dune and ventures up. Hendricks stops him with a wave off, saying something at the same time. Brody nods understanding and steps up cautiously and looks down. He adjusts his glasses, trying to make sense of what he is looking at. Whatever he sees has a marked effect on his entire physique. Kicking out with his foot, Brody sends dozens of angry horseshoe crabs into an escape frenzy, and they boil over the top of the dune and down its slopes. Cassidy takes a few uneasy steps backwards when Brody waves him over. He shakes his head, an awkward moment. Then Cassidy shuffles forward and up the few remaining feet, his eyes looking everywhere but down. Brody says something else, and Cassidy shakes his head again, eyes out at sea. Brody puts his hand gently around the quaking man's shoulder. Nodding, he starts to look down, an inch at a time. He looks. He, too, can't make out what it is at first. Then he understands. The jolt that assaults Cassidy is not unexpected. He falls backward in a sitting position as though shot. Nods yes. It's her. Brody turns and slides off the dune, stumbling close. Hear his breathing. He looks around, envisioning the week ahead of him. Quick, sharp cut. Chrissy's remains, incomplete from the chest down, horribly bitten. Note, see Hooper's dialogue in scene 91 for a complete description of corpse. Interior Brody's office, day. Brody walks through the door and enters his office, holding a fizzing glass of Alka-Seltzer. Polly, his 61-year-old secretary, follows close on his heels with her shorthand pad of messages and reminders. In the outer office, Hendricks and Cassidy slump into chairs, sipping from fizzing Dixie cups. Brody dips into the file drawers for the appropriate forms. He gently turns to Polly, who is behind him.
If this is going to work, you've got to keep current stuff out here and put closed files in there. The pending stay on my desk, okay?
Brody slips behind his typewriter, putting paper in the machine with the effortless ease of years of practice. He's obviously no stranger to paperwork. He touch types, hardly ever looking down, checking his notes and listening with one ear to Polly. He's affected by what he's seen, but there's work to be done. Polly.
This is in no order of importance, Chief. There's a meeting on the Amity Town Council on Aging this Monday night, Benton Court Hall. The fire inspector wants to go over the fireworks site with him before he catches the 1 o'clock ferry. Mainly, you have a batch of calls about that new karate school.
Close. Accident report. Brody has just typed the girl's name. He skips the space for cause of death and just under it types the next of kin information he's collected from her wallet.
Okay, well, that was the script read. I hope it wasn't too terrible for you. I hope you enjoyed it. Now, this is going to be a little bit interesting because the way that script was written is not the way scripts are written today. There's a lot of prose in that script, as you might have noticed. That is unheard of today. I think in part it was probably unheard of back in the 70s to some degree. I think when you have
the novelist writing the script, he wants to put some prose in his script. That's who he is. That's what he does. But the other interesting thing is how different the script is from the movie. The script's tone is totally different. It's a drama about the rich and this monster that is torturing them. I think you're supposed to take joy in the fact. I've not read the novel. I should ask my nephew. He's read the novel. But that's what the movie was about. And Steven Spielberg changed it into a brilliant suspense picture. And that's something that we're going to get back to quite a bit throughout this podcast, which are the differences between what Benchley seemed to be creating and even Steven Spielberg's writer, Carl Gottlieb, who's the other writer that's credited on the draft of the script that I have.
Let's talk elements of Jaws.
So in those first 10 pages, we get a couple of very basic things that are going to come back for Pulp Fiction. When we talked about this, it was things like title cards and the kind of characters that we meet and a certain level of the tone. In this, it's the shark hunt. It starts with the shark hunt. We get back to the shark hunt. Heck, the shark hunt might very well be the most famous aspect of Jaws. Right? The other thing that we see a lot is the innocent victim. That comes back. We get that early on. In the script, we have Brody as the simple man amongst the rich. In the film, we have Brody as the outsider, both among the island folk and the water, something he does not want to go into. Those are, as far as I can figure, those are the basic elements that are set up in those first 10 pages. It's really all we need outside of the character building, the story building, I mean, in terms of just setting up what it is for the reader and viewer that they're going to see here in those first 10 pages. Let's talk the writer's approach. Okay, so let's ask, how do Gottlieb and Benchley grab their reader in those first 10 pages? Do they grab the reader in the first 10 pages? Do they succeed at making a movie, a script, that somebody's going to want to read to the end? Well, clearly they did, even though somebody changed everything, at least tonally. But they accomplished what they had to accomplish, which is getting somebody into that script and to the end of it, right? Obviously, Benchley first, in part because of a successful book, and then Gottlieb making changes at the behest of Spielberg. But still, those first 10 pages are important. They're important for capturing the attention of whoever's going to read them, right? Right. So how did they accomplish that? Benchley, I would imagine, mostly set that scene beautifully by introducing that shark early on, showing that he's just hanging out off the water, ready to eat somebody who's rich and about 20 years old. Young people getting killed is always great, right? He does it with a little bit of, you know, kind of a slow tempo at first. He really sets that scene. He really draws in the reader. There's a lot of prose in this script. And then juxtaposing that with a mostly playful scene at home. So it's not just that it's the juxtaposition of the two things. It's also that he portrays, and they're portraying, Brody and Ellen as a fun couple. So by making them fun, they're more empathetic, they're more interesting. That's how you engage your reader. Now, let's just briefly talk about one of the strange things that was in that script. I kept it in when I got confused by what I was reading. There's that whole bit about Brody going through old things of his, where he's saying he used to wear this to various events, and then dog shit and muggers, he used to wear that sweater to dog shit? Is there dog shit on the sweater? Is the sweater dog shit? Did muggers take his sweater? That whole bit, I read it a couple of times. I read the stage direction, so what you heard me read is what was on the page. There was no additional direction, nothing in the action that explained better what that was. It's no wonder Spielberg cut it. It's very confusing. It was unnecessary. All it does is further support that Brody is a new guy on the island, even after being there for a few months. The other thing I want to briefly talk about is the changes to the discovering the body scene of the swimmer. That one is very interesting because Benchley's version is very effective. It's all in silence. I don't know if you got that from the script read, but there's no dialogue that we hear during that. It's wind and ocean and Brody dragging the kid over and then stopping the kid so he can go look at the body and then pulling the kid so the kid can say yes, that's the girl that he was with that's missing. It's a very good example of show, don't tell. However, Spielberg changed that probably for expediency. He wanted to get into
the real conflict, which is Brody going to close the beaches and having to sort of battle between his duty and what is being asked of him by the island's leaders. For that movie and for the suspense, that is more necessary than taking the time to slowly reveal this body and slowly reveal the kid seeing the body and all of that. So a very good moment on the page, but I completely see why Spielberg made those changes, and we'll talk about more of that next.
Let's talk Spielberg. The first difference is right here. It breaks wide, showing the top and bottom, a silhouetted curtain of razor-sharp teeth suggesting that we are inside the tremendous gullet of the shark.
Well, Spielberg took this concept and altered it to what we can imagine maybe the shark's point of view. He's not quite as on the nose as the text suggested. Already, Spielberg has decided to take the movie and the tone of the movie in a different direction than intended, which I find fascinating. From the point of view of nearly 50 years of pop culture, when I read the line, also the hint of familiar music twisted and distorted by the depths, in my head, that brought up the sound of John Williams's hunting shark theme, the doo-doo. But what Gottlieb and Benchley meant here was that the songs we're hearing are old school alma mater songs.
It really makes it seem like it's in the 1950s. You know, I don't know about you, I pictured guys in like old fashioned Letterman jackets, or even worse, those raccoon coats, you know, the kind you'd see Foghorn Leghorn wearing in a 1940s cartoon. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just Google all those things. Just trust me. Spielberg was smart enough to get rid of all of that and just make it, you know, kids hanging around a fire, getting high, making music, getting drunk, whatever. That's what it should have been. I don't know why it was anything else. And it was a strange choice by Benchley. Probably a strange choice that he had in his script, because it's supposed to be the rich people versus the not-so-rich Brody. I mean, I imagine, because that seemed to be what was going on in the script version of this. So, I don't know. Changing all that stuff was a great idea. And it, again, it helps set everything up very cleanly in those first 10 minutes, but not necessarily the first 10 pages.
Another difference Spielberg made was to add suspense to the story. Benchley's version is not really a suspense thriller, folks. It's more of a story of rich people's lives being upended by a monster they can't control, and the only person who can help them is the outsider, Chief Brody. It kind of sounds like a Clint Eastwood Western when you put it that way, you know? But yeah, Spielberg decided to make this a suspense movie. You know, obviously there's reasons that we didn't see the shark earlier, but it seems to me that the decision to not see the shark in that first sequence had nothing to do with the mechanics of the shark. It had to do more with the mechanics of the movie. This is a good time to mention that I saw an interesting tweet just recently. Someone had tweeted out that their children found Jaws boring. I don't know if that's a real tweet. I find that hard to believe for one reason. This is a movie that opens with a sexy naked lady getting eaten viciously by a shark. What kid finds that boring? Which is the boring part? The naked lady or the getting eaten by an animal in the sea? I don't know how you top it. I mean, I guess you can make it a Sharknado. A Sharknado eating more naked people. Oh, a Sharknado orgy. Oh my god, I think I just wrote the sequel to Sharknado. Okay, I'm copywriting it, no one steal it. Well, I guess I can't copyright it, someone else's Sharknado. Damn it. Ooh, Tortuganado. Add an orgy. I'll workshop it later. I do want to mention also Susan Baclini. Who is Susan Baclini? She's the naked lady. That performance, when she's getting attacked, is absolutely amazing and 100% believable. The first response, she's not quite sure what's going on, and then she's probably bitten, we're not really sure yet, but she seems to be going into shock. She's shivering, like she does that, and it's kind of amazing. And then there's an oh god no, and oh please someone help me that she screams out as she's getting just torn apart by the shark, just dragged back and forth. It's an absolutely incredible performance, and it's something that everyone overlooks. Everyone always talks about Roy Scheider and Richard Dreyfuss and Robert Shaw. And this woman opens one of the most famous films of all time, and I hardly ever see any talk about her and that amazing, you know, 3 minutes, if that, that she has on camera. It's very effective. All right. Let's talk Roy. After the chase and the woman is attacked, the chase on the beach, I mean, and the woman is attacked, we cut to the morning and meet Roy Scheider's Brody. We learn through some expert dialogue that he's new to the island and that he came from the big city, New York City, presumably to take this cushy job so that he can raise his kids in idyllic peace, away from the dangers of New York. That is said a little bit more clearly later on, but the pipe is laid for that a little more subtly. But a lot of it is not really said outright, not in the script, not in the version Spielberg filmed. It's a lot of the subtext. It's in the conversation about the accent for Yad and the idea that Brody is looking 30 years into his future after leaving the big city police life and looking out into the window to watch the kids play and being so protective that something as minor as Rusty swing set upsets him. You know, he wants everything to be a quiet, happy life for his family here in their new home. You're not even fully aware of it, that those are the things that he's doing, but you do know it. You know it as you go. You get to know him and what it is his motivation is through all of this. I also like the detail that they've been there since the fall. There's a comment about why is the light coming in through the window differently? And the wife says, because we moved here in the fall and now it's summer. There's this idea that they left before New York City's harsh winter. My point in all this is that this whole sequence in the house is sort of this little, fast, quiet bit of exposition with almost zero actual exposition in it. You know, his wife Ellen doesn't say, "You came from the big city to just take it easy," which is the kind of line you'd see in pretty much any blockbuster of today, so that audiences get it. But Spielberg's take on this was a little different from the script's. So let's talk some of the script changes. Changes to these scenes include the playful argument about the tea kettle. Spielberg may have felt that even playfully, they shouldn't argue, Brody and Ellen. He instead shows them as a fun, loving, comfortable couple. Maybe he just wanted to cut down on the scene a bit. That's possible too. There are a few things that make the scene quicker and easier. For example, the easier choice was he went for one Cocker Spaniel instead of two. Although Ellen does say feed the dogs, but unless I missed it, there's only one there. But you know what? Quite honestly, Cocker Spaniels are mean little shits. So it's better to have one than two. And if you don't agree with that, I'll give you an address you can send your letters to later. Just wait to the very, very, very end of the podcast. That's where that address will be. No, really, it'll be there. Just wait. Another thing that makes the scene breezier is the crosstalk. A difference here is that the son's dialogue with his parents is cut down, but the scene has added dialogue about asking to go swimming, dialogue which is said in the background as Brody is on the phone with his office, finding out about the missing girl. Clearly, Spielberg, I imagine, I shouldn't say clearly, just wanted to get into the meat that gets the plot going, that being Brody versus the grand old guard of the town that is less concerned about a shark and more concerned about losing tourist dollars. So him wanting to speed this along gives us what was then an unusual moment where characters are talking over each other, something you didn't really see a lot of in the movies. You still don't see a great deal of it unless it's like a comedy and they're doing it for the purpose of making something seem frenetic and funny. The idea of crosstalk, as far as I'm aware, is most often attributed to Robert Altman with, I think, MASH, the movie upon which the famous series was based. It was, as far as I'm aware, one of the first films to utilize that technique. Altman was a big deal in the 70s, and I imagine probably to some degree an influence on Spielberg. There's another really fun script change I want to get into, actually, which is, in the script, when Chief Brody is heading to his car, Ellen says to him, "Be careful." And his response is,
"Here, you gotta be kidding."
In the movie, it's a very slight change, but she says a much more kind of playful to fit in with the tone that Spielberg had already set up inside the house. "Hey, Chief, be careful, will ya?" Which just feels more familiar. Not that the script is terrible or anything, but there are some stiff moments of dialogue in the script that when I was reading it felt natural, but when you see it performed this way, "Hey, Chief, be careful, will ya?" And his response is, "In this town?" And he laughs, as if to say, "You gotta be kidding," without actually saying, "You gotta be kidding." It's another little touch that's absolutely wonderful. Speaking of little touches, there's a great little touch in the kitchen, which is that the phone rings, and it's the police line, but Brody answers the home phone, the implication being that the police line rings so little, so rarely, that he wasn't expecting it, and he's actually a little confused when it is the police line, which again plays into him getting out of New York and coming here for peace. The actress that played Ellen Brody is Lorraine Gary. Well, we should give credit where credit's due. No reason not to mention Lorraine. She was great in that movie. But let's stop for a second and take note. As soon as he steps outside, his wife calls him Chief. So no longer in his home, he's now a cop. And his truck, which I thought was interesting, and don't forget, this is a movie, it's not a documentary. Everything is a choice. How a set is dressed is a choice. Where the truck is parked is a choice. So the house doesn't open up into the driveway, which I think is what it said in the script. I'm not gonna flip through it. It might have said it in the script. But the white picket fence frames the yard and frames the house, and he has to step outside of the comfort of his home to then become a police chief and step into his truck. He's trying to keep the monsters at bay, and they're literally right outside his home. At any rate, it's a very cool choice. Let's move on to the next thing. Yeah, yeah. So not only did Spielberg remove the contrast between the rich people of the island and Brody's regular guy, because that's not the contrast that's played up in the film. The contrast is that he's just not one of them. As you hear me reading this script, understand that these first 10 pages do reflect the movie that Benchley and Gottlieb wrote here. It's more the story of a town that is terrorized by both itself and the shark, whereas what Spielberg ended up crafting was a thriller about a killer shark and Brody's character, who doesn't belong there, but has got to stop it. By the way, speaking of, as I did a moment ago about giving credit where credit is due, I just want to mention Carl Gottlieb began writing for the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. If you've never looked up or watched any of the 1960s Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour on YouTube, I don't know if there's still clips there, but for a while there was a whole bunch of clips, and some of them still stand up. If you know anything about 60s politics, they're especially funny. If you don't know anything about 60s politics, some of them are still really funny, and they're worth a look. He won an Emmy in 69. He also wrote for the well-known 70s series, The Bob Newhart Show, All in the Family, and The Odd Couple. There's a lot of comedic stuff in the movie that isn't in the script at all. Brody at one point says, "That's one bad hat, Harry," which is a famous line and is now used as the title card for a director and producer who shall remain nameless. You could Google it if you're so interested. And then there's that scene, "It's a tiger shark."
What?
That's not in the script. Roy Scheider's,
"Show me the tank and smile, you son of a,"
before he shoots Jaws out of the ocean. That's not in the script. And of course, "We're going to need a bigger boat," which is both terrifyingly accurate and extremely funny, is also not in the script. Quint's speech, which ends with, "Anyway, we delivered the bomb." That speech, there is a controversy apparently about who wrote that speech. That is not going to be solved in this podcast. Sorry. If you're someone who's into Jaws and was hoping that would be discussed in great detail and that I would do some sort of detective work and figure that out, ain't gonna happen, guys. But I can tell you this, looking at this script, it's on the page almost word for word. So Shaw's name isn't on the top of this script. It's Gottlieb and Benchley. So that's all I can say about that. I don't know what that means. So what did we see in the first 10 pages? Spielberg definitely decided to push towards a suspense film rather than just a drama about dueling classes. I think history has perhaps proven all his choices to be, yes, spot on that. So that's it for today and for me. I'm Keith. This was the Jaws 50th anniversary episode of The First 10 Pages. If you want to find me online, I'm active on Blue Sky, which is like Twitter but not, and Instagram at The Reality Comics. That's The Reality Comics, C-O-M-I-C-S, on both of those platforms. Thank you so much for listening. See you at the table read. The First 10 Pages is written, hosted, and edited by Keith Planet. Music by Edison Carter. Any corrections, questions, or comments, please reach out via social media on Blue Sky or Instagram at The Reality Comics. The First 10 Pages, copyright 2025.